I had one question that I should like to sort of pose to you, and that is something that you could readily look up. And the question was, how big is a thing like this? The reason I want to treat this is that immediately suggests a difficulty. It's a woolly object, you know, it's not something like, it has an outer photosphere like a star or something like that. Where does it begin? Well, you think that it begins in the center of light over here, which is presumably also the center of mass. But then it peters out. Does it stop here? Or does it stop there? Does it stop there? That's not really quite clear. One of the difficulties when connecting with observations is precisely this, right? That the quantitative properties of objects like this are not easily summarized. You can, of course, say, well, what you see is what you get. This is the object, right? Just where the individual stars are. But that is not what theory is all about. You want to say global things about such structures. What people frequently do, and we get to be talking about this in the course of the lectures, is to take what is known as the half-mass radius. You start with where you think the center of luminosity is, which is approximately here in this image, and then you take bigger and bigger and bigger spheres and you just count the total amount of stuff in there. And you say, well, the size of this I take when I've reached approximately half the size of the hole that it encounters. So this thing sort of converges out to a background field here, and where you have half the mass is what you call the object size. This, of course, begs a number of questions. One of the questions it begs is that possibly you're misguided in that you're assuming, when trying to find the half mass radius here, you're assuming that mass and luminosity trace one another. And this is not necessarily the case. As we will be talking about later, there is in systems like this a tendency for the most massive objects to collect in the center, for reasons that we get to be talking about, which means that when you go further out, you get selectively less massive objects. And the mass-to-luminosity ratio changes, of course, when you go further out. So it's difficulties like this that you've got to deal with. What I would recommend is that you just look up, either in the book or preferably on the web, what typical sizes for objects like this are, and form yourself an opinion. Sir, you had a question.
What is this radius on this object towards the
bottom? Oh, this thing here? Yeah. In this particular case, I don't know. I would guess it's a planetary nebula. Just judging from the red color, it's almost certainly that's the H-alpha line. Most likely, yes, because when you look at all these various red stars over here, they are precursors of planetary nebulae, right? Now, planetary nebula is a solar mass type star that has shed its outer atmosphere. The total lifetime of this is not very long as compared with the total lifetime of a globular cluster like this. So this is a very instantaneous thing over here. In this specific case, however, I am not certain. I suspect it's a planetary, but I'd have to look it up. Yeah. Sir? Ah, good question. It's already on here. The size of a planetary is typically of the order of 500ths to 1/10th of a parsec. Now just fill in that number here and you get an idea. I can already tell. It's a good question. I already tell the answer is no, but you'd have to look up the numbers. But again, you know, there's a question like that really emphasizes the power of seemingly trivial equations of this sort. It's already in there. Okay. Well then.
But that is assuming that our star would collide with the nebula. What about the tidal forces?
Yes, another good question. I was sort of getting ahead of myself a little bit here. I was going to introduce that point after having done the two-body problem. But you can already get some impression in the following way. Suppose you have a star over here, and you have another one coming by. We will, in a moment, be doing solving the two-body problem exactly. But you can sort of ask yourself, what is this particular distance? Because if you know that, then you know what the interception cross-section is, your corresponding sigma. Then you might say, well, how do I know what this radius is supposed to be. To do that, you have to define what you mean by a strong collision. And that means that this angle is approximately 1 radian or something of that sort. Take a half a radian, I don't care. Right. You know that that depends on the velocity of the incoming object, right? And therefore, this sigma over here already turns out to be a function of the velocity of the incoming star. And therefore, the consequences of a collision and the mean free path, as over here, is also a function of velocity. Ah, and already in a nutshell, by a small question like this, you get to see the various ingredients of stellar dynamics. Why dynamics? Because the velocity is in here. So far, when looking at this equation over here, you might have had the impression that it is really a little bit too simple for an introductory course on a master's level. But you can see that hidden behind beneath the surface here is already an immense amount of actual dynamics, actual details, right? And that is because of this, right? That's just for a collision. Now your question about tides, right? Again, you have a star here, and you have another one going by. The question is, how big is the tidal effect over here? It is certainly going to be present even if this distance over here is much bigger than the stellar radius, right? But how much depends on a lot of things. For instance, it depends on the amount of central concentration of this object over here, right? It depends on the physical size of this object over here. And that links, I hadn't not really intended to say that at this particular point, but I will, I'll be coming back to it later. That links immediately again to stellar evolution, not only the formation of possible planetaries of this sort, but also the formation of giant stars. From this image already, you can see that there are many giants, okay, these red things over here also, red giant stars. They're not called giants for nothing. They're bigger. And because they're physically bigger and more fluffy, they get more easily perturbed by a tidal encounter like this. Now, think about it. What does this mean when we think about stellar dynamics? It instantly tells us that stellar dynamics could not possibly, in a realistic case, be a course in applied classical mechanics. You need to involve stellar evolution. You already see that there are evolved stars in here. You can surmise that there are many, many white dwarf stars in here that contribute to the mass, but they're exceedingly small and do not contribute to the luminosity. There may be even the odd neutron stars, or even, as you mentioned a moment ago, black holes lurking around. All those are products of stellar evolution. And the stellar evolution changes the dynamical behavior of a system like this just simply because it changes the sizes of the stars and the mass distribution of the stars, all right? So this points to what I said in the very beginning of my overall introduction, that stellar dynamics is linked to basically all of astrophysics by effects like this. And lest you think these effects are small, Professor Portugis-Swart's research group over here is dealing with this stuff in immense detail precisely because of this reason, all right? Why it is that possibly small effects like this play an important role in stellar dynamics, you get to talk about in a moment. All right, you might think of, well, you know, this is a 10 to the minus 5 effects, who cares? But I'll show you that you will have to care. As I promised before the break, I will tick off with you for a moment now what we will need from the literature. Right, I will just do this first from the Binney and Termain book, and then I'll mention two other books that are useful for this general subject, but that we will not be quoting in detail in the lecture series. I'm just quoting from the index of the book over here. All right, the first chapter is about observations. I already mentioned what I'd like you to do about this. Just do it yourself. Just go read up, maybe with the book in hand, and read up as quantitatively as possible what you can find about observations of stellar systems. And I don't really mean any arcane details about star formation or something like that, but just concentrate on objects that more or less look like this: dwarf galaxies, spiral galaxies, elliptical galaxies, and so on and so forth. Then there is chapter 2. Chapter 2 in the book is called Potential Theory. I'll be talking about that a little bit, in particular about section 2.2, so-called simple potentials, and I will emphasize the Plummer-Kuzmin workhorse type potential, because that is a rough and ready type thing which is extremely useful to remember. In fact, I can already tell you that this particular cross section looks rather similar to the so-called Plummer potential distribution. I will skip elliptical potentials for the moment. They're a technical detail that you would need when you study galactic structure, but for the dynamics part, it is not so very important. But I will talk about chapter 2.8, section 2.8, when we talk about numerical methods. And we'll try to explain to you why it is that certain numerical methods have been developed in a particular way. And for the rest, I will refer you for the connection to Professor Porter Hiswart's lecture series. Then there is section 3 about orbits. That we will get to talk about in a moment. I will lean very much more heavily on the dynamics, as already indicated, but you will see that straightforward in a moment. Chapter 3.1, section 3.1, is about the motion of bodies in an external potential. And that is something that you can already see on the projection over here. If you just sort of look through your eyelashes or you defocus the projector here a little bit, all this stuff smears out into a more or less continuous distribution with a higher intensity in the center and less on the outside. That will give you some feel for what a star feels. If you're an individual star, you move here under the influence of the collective effects of all the other stars. What individual stellar encounters do, we will get to talk about in some detail. And that is why the book does treat in section 3.1 a single body in an external potential. And of course, in the course of in the book, that is a logical thing to follow this construction of potentials to begin with. Then section 3.2 talks about orbits in axisymmetric potentials. Now, this is a special case, but in astrophysics it is extremely important. Spherical or spherical-like objects like this are, of course, axisymmetric, spherical symmetric, and axisymmetric potentials, such as in disk galaxies, are very common. I will focus on one particular aspect of this, and that is to say the so-called epicyclic approximation. That is to say, we will be looking at the orbits of objects that are in circular orbits in an axisymmetric potential, but that are almost circular. And we will see why it is that this is called the epicyclic approximation. Then we'll skip to 3.5, and we will talk about phase spaces. Why we talk about phase space, what it is, and how it uses is useful for stellar dynamics, we will get to be talking about. Then there is chapter 4, which has a rather misleading title. It is called Equilibrium Configurations. And as I will try to demonstrate to you again and again and again, there is no such thing as an equilibrium stellar system, for a reason that we get to explain shortly. None of these systems, not globular clusters, not galaxies or nothing, are possibly in equilibrium. Not in practice, not even possible. We'll be basically taking in sections 4, 1, 2, 3, 4 and 5, so 4.1 through 4.5, and section 4.7 from the equilibrium structures. The next one, but then we're already halfway in the course, we were talking about stability. From a structure like this, which looks so nice and relaxed, you would already be tempted to conclude that systems like this are stable. And to a certain extent they are, and to a certain extent they are not. Right? And stability is something that we will have to consider in great detail. Of course, when talking about the structure of individual galaxies, stability problems are even more important than they will be in this particular course. And the reason for this being that you know perfectly well that seemingly isolated systems, such as flat galaxies, have spiral structures. And these spiral structures are presumably due to some form of instability in these galaxies. Chapter 6, we will skip spiral galaxies. We will talk a lot about Chapter 7, collisions and encounters. And in particular, we will be talking about an effect known as dynamical friction. Dynamical friction turns out to play a key role in the long-term evolution of stellar systems. And it is the proper treatment of this that is, in fact, very, very difficult. And that, again, relates to some of the practical things that Professor Portegis-Swart will be teaching you in his lecture series. Chapter 8, we will be doing, to a certain extent, kinetic theory. It will probably come a lot earlier in this course than it is in the book. As I've already mentioned, I will be leaning very heavily on the dynamics part of things, and kinetic structure and kinetic theory is something that really is part and parcel of a dynamical system, and therefore we'll probably get to be dealing with this a little bit earlier than it is in the book. We will skip chapter 9. We will mention some of the parts of this, but there's not really part of it. And I hope, but now we're towards the end of the course, I hope to be able to say at least something about chapter 10, the role of dark stuff, as it were. You will never be hearing me say dark matter, because we don't know what it is, all right? I mean, if you say dark matter, you're already presuming that you know what the composition is, made of particles or whatever. We haven't the foggiest idea what it is. 96% of our universe is dark stuff, right? And it plays an important role in stellar dynamics on a larger scale, in particular, where we're going to be talking about galaxies and clusters of galaxies. We will do this not in really very much detail, but I hope to be getting to chapter 10 in the book, at least to some extent. That's it for the general plan, then, for the book by Binney and Tremaine. You'll be seeing this popping up again and again. It has an absolutely excellent index, so if you want to look things up, just do it by finding the proper terms. It's always difficult to select a textbook for a lecture series, and I have been tempted for a moment to use this particular one, which is a book by Saslaw, which I recommend, edited by Cambridge University Press, and it is called Gravitational Physics of Stellar and Galactic Systems. The reason I like it is that it is much more dynamical, in a sense, than the book by Binney and Tremaine, and it is much less geared towards explaining the structure of individual galaxies. On the other hand, it does not mesh very well, it does not fit very well in all the other forms of astronomy that you will be dealing with in your educational career here. And that is why I've chosen not to take this book, although it is really very, very good indeed. all of stellar dynamics is effectively built on the two-body problem, on orbital mechanics. And that is why I have selected for you here a book called Orbital Motion by a person called Roy, A.E. Roy. And it will not be very useful for your astronomical career unless you're deeply into satellites and things like that. But it is a very, very good introduction to how classical mechanics really is cosmic mechanics, in a sense. And in fact, even today, I will be quoting from it when we talk about the two-body problem, which is a very nice exact solution summarized in this book. That's just a few of them. Those of you who prefer browsing around on the web or in the library, there are literally hundreds of books on the subject, all right, but these are the ones that I recommend for this particular lecture series. Well then, let's now talk dynamics. Stellar dynamics is mostly thought of and sort of intuitively grasped as something to deal with the collective motion of a very, very large number of stars. Thousands, millions, billions even in the case of a galaxy. Right? And yet the paradoxical fact is that the evolution of a stellar system depends crucially on the behavior on the smallest scale, behavior of two and three body systems. Why is this? I think that when you think about it for a moment and you realize what classical mechanics is really like, you will instantly grasp by looking at this image of your globular cluster why it must be that the small scale effects play a very important role. And now comes something that I will probably be repeating 100 times in this lecture series until it has become part of your inner cortex. Okay, and that is the following. Two-body encounters in a stellar system are elastic encounters where angular momentum and energy and mass are all perfectly conserved. Well, if that is so, a system like an n-body system just plain simply cannot evolve. But it does, and it must. Why? Because when looking at a two-body encounter like this, you will realize that in the case in point, the potential is a 1 over r potential. It is a bottomless pit. And because this mean free path is so enormous that we were talking about earlier, you are justified to a very large level of precision by considering stars as point masses. And a point mass is something that has a potential that goes as 1 over r, and it has no bottom. And therefore, if in a stellar system I take two objects, two stars, and I bring them closer and closer and closer and closer together, you know from energy conservation that you gain thereby an arbitrary amount of energy. Why arbitrary? Because the potential is 1 over r. It's bottomless. If you want more energy, you just bring the particles closer together. No problem. Where does that energy go? That energy goes into all the other points. In other words, looking at a stellar system that you saw just a moment ago, a globular cluster like this, or a similar stellar system, you already realize that if indeed it is 1 over r interaction between the various particles in that system, you cannot be looking at an equilibrium system. There is only an asymptotic state where two of those 10 to the however many there are bodies are infinitely close together and everybody else is out at infinity. That's what you will ultimately end up with, you'd think. All right. And that's because of this bizarre behavior of the potential over here. Wait a minute. I can sort of feel an objection being raised in your head because I just started by saying that a two-body encounter is conservative. And I said that a stellar system like this would have an asymptotic state where two particles are infinitely close together and everybody else is infinitely far apart. That can't be reached, that state. Because every individual particle-particle encounter is conservative. How could I possibly change the system? The system can change because if there is anywhere in that stellar system a binary, just two stars close together, then that binary, the stars going around one another, that binary may behave like this energy source, this infinite energy source that I mentioned earlier. Because if now a star comes by, it interacts not with a point source, like in this case, but it interacts with an active object, with a binary star. And this binary can then get closer together, and the energy is gained by this thing over here that gets a faster speed after the interaction than when it came in. Now, that means then that the dynamical processes that drive the secular evolution, the long-term evolution of this stellar system, is dominated by small number encounters of this sort. looking ahead a little bit, and it's particularly important for those of you who will be following Portuguese Swartz lecture series, that means that if computationally you want to understand what happens in a stellar system, the very first order of business is to make certain that you treat small number encounters, like 2 and 3 body encounters, properly. But now you understand the basis computationally of the difficulty. Your typical speed of a star on the outskirts of a globular cluster is 1, 2, 3, 5 kilometers per second or something thereabouts. Not worth really to be writing home about. Very slow, very big, very gentle, very nothing. Proper timescales then run in the, whatever it is, millions of years or something of that general sort. You know, 1 kilometer per second is 1 parsec in a million years. Okay, so again, get some idea about the timescales. The orbital timescale of a hard binary, where the two stars are, let us say, a half an astronomical unit apart or something of that general sort, is very, very brief. You know, it's of the order of a year or less. So you have a mismatch immediately already of a factor of 10 to the 6 or 10 to the 7 or something thereabouts, and that whole dynamic range will have to be covered by your numerical method, or else you'll be doing something wrong. All right. So in order to do 10 to the 6 bodies properly, you have to do certainly 3 bodies right. Well, this is a difficulty. All right. From the point of view of the build-up of this lecture series, then, it is not inappropriate to do it in the following way. To start with the one-body problem, and then continue with the 2-body, 3-body, and all the way to n is large, at least for these purposes, of the order of a million or something thereabouts. And that's approximately what I intend to do. Now, it may seem strange to start with the 1-body problem. Well, not necessarily. If you write down your equation of motion, you know what this is going to be like, right? You will have dv by dt equals g, where g is some external acceleration. In the textbook, we just mentioned this a moment ago, you will already find this, where the acceleration term is due to a potential, all right, where your acceleration is given by the average distribution of mass in the object. And that will give you individual orbits. We'll be getting to be talking about this in a moment. Alternatively, your acceleration is given by an individual star, right? In which case, you get to deal with your point masses. Okay, so your individual star, which gives you your 1 over r potential that I just mentioned a moment ago, and your typical 1 over r squared, your 1 over r squared force law. Now, this we're going to be talking about. This requires some extra thought because the potential that you are moving in depends on the overall distribution of the stars, but it can also depend on the outside world. And this is a connection that I want to make right here. We will be not talking about this for the moment, but just simply wanted to show you what the various connections possibly are. If this external potential in which the single object, the single star, moves is given by the overall distribution of the stars in the object, in the globular cluster in this particular case, that's one thing, but also there may be a contribution from the rest of the world. A globular cluster is orbiting itself in a galaxy. And so you will also have to take this into account, and therefore tidal effects of the rest of the mass of the universe on your stellar system are also of importance. And you can already see that this is going to be extremely complicated. We'll be coming back to this in detail later. Let's for the moment concentrate on this. The one-body problem is by no means as trivial as it might seem. And I want to introduce this to you because it's really dear to my heart. It explains extremely well the way in which certain physical theories are built. I want to talk with you about the way an individual body behaves. And that brings up the problem of the relativity of position and velocity. Almost always, in courses in classical mechanics, people start with the postulates of Isaac Newton. Those postulates as mathematical things that bear no resemblance to the universe around us. There was another person who did this, in my opinion, much better, who was Christian Huygens, who wrote these six words over here. And let us look at what they mean and what they imply for the one-body problem. This is a line that is present in the university library over here where I took this photograph. And in Latin it says, motus inter corpora relativus tantum est, or the mutual motion of objects is entirely relative. Notice, those of you who have had some Latin, that it doesn't say motus corporum, the motion of objects, as if an object had a motion, an orbit. No, it says motus inter corpora, the mutual motion of objects is entirely relative. Later in his writings, Huygens sort of reiterated this, that position and velocity of an object are not observable. Think about that one body problem, okay? Follow his lines over here. Quid nam in corpore, Quid nam in corporibus, we're reading here, quia sit aut motus, nisi aliorum corporum respectu non videtur intellegi posse. Whether or not an object is standing still or moves is something that we notice, videtur, that we notice cannot be observed, nisi aliorum corporum, unless with respect to other objects. This is very profound physics. Position is not an observable property. A particle doesn't have a position. You wouldn't know where you are. You wouldn't know where a particle is, only with respect to one another. If you were to design your own universe, you would not have to do it like this. Position of a particle could be just as observable as the charge of the electron, but it isn't. Similarly, it says that motus inter corpore relativus tantum est is also the velocity of an object is not unobservable. You don't know how fast you're going. If you did, you would be feeling by the seat of your pants that at this very moment we're moving at 600 kilometers a second in the direction of the Goma cluster of galaxies. You do not feel this. You don't know how fast you're going. Velocity is not unobservable. There's no reason why we know this. If you design your own universe, you could make velocity precisely as observable as, let us say, the electric field strength. But you can't. You don't know how fast you're going. All right. What does this do, this relativity for position and velocity, for building up mechanics? Well, that means the following. If I take a position, I can add a constant number to it. I can give it a constant translation. And therefore, the differential of a position is invariant under a constant translation. That means then that there is an object called velocity, which is the ratio of this difference of position and the difference of time. You don't work with positions, you work with the difference of position because position is relative. Now also, velocity is relative, and therefore to any velocity I can add a constant velocity translation. Every whole universe can move with a constant velocity in a given direction. That also means that the change of velocity is an invariant under this operation, and therefore it is the acceleration that plays the key role in mechanics. So it is in this way that the necessity of building up differential equations is demonstrated. We must use differential equations because absolute position and absolute velocity have no meaning in this universe. Position and velocity are not observables. This is totally modern physics. And in fact, these things are called symmetry transformations, and all of known physics is built on symmetries. In other words, mechanics as we know it is complicated, and you guys will have to slog through the first 2 years of your bachelor's education doing differential equations, because mechanics is a change of a change. That is what you have to compute. And that is just a one-body problem, right? Now, how about the two-body problem? In order to do that properly, you would have to have your equations of motion. I already have it on the blackboard over here. This is what we have to solve, right? What I will do is I will quote from the book by Roy, which in my opinion is the best explanation of the two-body problem. So in this book over here, what you need is section 4.4, in which the two-body problem is solved exactly in a very nice, compact, and concise way. Unfortunately, I ran out of time a little bit, so there is no time for me to do it today, but I'll be summarizing it for you the next time around. Of course, you know the answer already, right? The two-body problem is solved exactly in the Newtonian format over here for two-point masses. I have them already on the blackboard over here. You have a hyperbolic orbit, which is one possible case. You have the elliptic orbit over here, and the sort of pathological case in between, which is a parabolic orbit, which we almost never seriously consider. Let us see how we connect these with our total overall subject of stellar dynamics. One is that, and I really recommend you do this numerically, that you can compute what the interception cross-section is for a hyperbolic encounter. And in this hyperbolic encounter, the incoming speed, of course, is important. The second thing is that is much more complicated, and we will not be talking about this in much detail right now, that I mentioned to you earlier that the two-body solution, the elliptical orbit over here, can be an infinite source of energy because the particles can be brought closer and closer and closer and closer together, thereby supplying the energy for blowing up the rest of the stellar system. However, you might instantly object that it is not obvious that on a three-body encounter, the binary, in fact, does get closer. Right? Why should it? Could also be scattered, could also be blown apart by an intruder. Now, interestingly enough, it turns out that the more compact a binary is, the more likely it is to get even more compact in a three-body encounter. All right, so there's what they call loose binaries, soft binaries that are very, very far apart with a long orbital period. They're likely to be disrupted by an encounter. What they call the hard binaries, where they're very close together in a very short short time scale orbit, those are the ones that get closer and closer and closer together as they interact with the rest of the system. This is not trivial. This is not something that you can instantly grasp, as it were. And of course, you will want to know quantitatively what do you mean precisely by a hard binary and by a soft binary. Maybe I should finish today by seeing if I can read from... Okay. There are several people who have been dealing with this problem, and it is essential because it is an important driver for the dynamics of the large system as a whole. What I'm going to say now is just sort of a funny way of expressing things by the various people who have been working on this, but there is a good dynamic underpinning for all of it. They were made up basically by two people who are the arch fathers, as it were, of this subject. One is Douglas Heggie, who has been visiting here regularly, and the other one is Sverre Arseth, who is a colleague at Cambridge University. What they do is they make a sort of funny comparison between being a binary and being criminal. And so when you're a binary, consider a binary as a criminal person. Heggie's first law says, the rate of hardening of a criminal is independent of his hardness once he has become a hard criminal. Right. So once you're really a very baddie, then you get worse and worse and worse, which is to say in this case that when the binary is very hard, it is likely to become harder and harder and harder when it interacts with, quote-unquote, society, which is the rest of the stars surrounding him. Heggie's second law. Very hard criminals are locked up by adiabatic invariants most of the time, so they only harden by committing relatively few but very violent crimes. while less hard criminals commit minor crimes more often. Right. So a very hard binary like this is almost always just doing what it does, moving around and around and around and around an ellipse. And then every now and then another star comes by and wham, something really violent happens. You can see this in the numerical simulations by Porter and Swart, and I recommend you that you look this up. So now you may wonder what it is that this interaction between the general population of stars and this binary pair does to the population of stars as a whole. All right, because already mentioned, by bringing these two together, you can blow up all the rest. All right. There is a rule that was effectively proven, I mean in a nice mathematical way, but I'll just give you the summary, by Sverre Arseth. Arseth's law says the following. Small societies, that is to say small groups of stars, small societies evolve until they are dominated by a central, very hard criminal who may expel other members of society, but he may eventually be displaced from his central position or even ejected altogether after a violent interaction with another member of society. In other words, if this is not a three-body encounter, but let us say a 300-body group, then an object like this may be displaced by another, even harder pair somewhere else in the population. So it is this kind of behavior that means that the second part of what we should like to do, namely going to a very, very large number of objects, is going to be so very difficult. You may have been wondering throughout my expostulation this morning why it is all so difficult. After all, a kilogram of water contains 10 to the 27 particles, right? We're not going to follow the orbits of all 10 to the 27 particles. Why not? Because we use thermodynamics for this, similarly with the gas in this room. Why can we not use thermodynamics in this particular case? Because there is no equilibrium. There's no ground state. There's no overall distribution like the Boltzmann distribution in the case of a gas that you know is the most probable of all possible distributions of particles. That on the average, the whole system will tend towards, even if you perturb it fairly violently. There is no such thing as equilibrium in an n-body gravitational system. And that is why this is such a strange subject. That is why this transition to very, very large number of particles, 10 to the 8 particles or something or other in a dwarf galaxy, this is not something that will be very easy. That is also explains the very big role that numerical computation plays in this case. There are no overall equilibrium laws that we can rely on like we can in the case of thermodynamics. So if we really want to do these want to know what these things do, we will jolly well have to actually do the computations, which is why I also commend the lecture series by Professor Porter Giswart. What is it that remains to be done now? I will, the next time around, demonstrate to you, to remind you, as it were, the two-body solution, and then we will start following Chapter 2, Potentials. We'll look at orbits in potentials, and then we'll get to deal with basically what the biggest central issue of this whole lecture series is, and it's already in the blackboard over here. If you have a particle moving in a potential, then that potential again is made up out of the motions of the individual particles. In other words, there is a self-consistency problem here. I have an overall potential in which a particle moves. The motion and distribution of the particles themselves generates that potential. Is it possible to find combinations of potential distribution and particle distribution that in fact match? That you can hope, maybe they're not in equilibrium, but you can hope at least are long-lived, as we know, for instance, those globular clusters are. That is going to be a central theme of this particular series, and we'll be coming back to this later.